Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 174. I'm really excited about today's guest because he's a guy I've had a chance to go back and forth with as I've learned more and more about Forest Plates, and they've become a more integral part of all of our offerings. Has really changed the way that I look at athlete development, and I think he has a ton of wisdom to share for folks who use Forest Plates, but also for people who may be contemplating utilizing them in the years ahead. I should also note that if you are interested in learning more about Hawken Dynamics Forest Plates, you can head to hawkendynamics.com/Cressy. That's H-A-W-K-I-N dynamics.com/Cressy. If you want to check it out and learn a little bit more, I'm sure he'd be happy to share some wisdom with you, just like he does on this podcast. So let's get to it. Overuse injuries have emerged as one of the biggest threats to players at every level of competition. As an example, at the professional level, ulnar collateral ligament injuries at the elbow alone sideline pitchers for an average of over 17 months. That's a ton of lost development and a threat to lengthy careers. Just as concerningly, though, for youth players, overuse is the predominant mechanism of injury. So what can be done? Obviously, we need to train athletes to be prepared for all the stresses the game throws at them. However, the other side of the equation, recovery, often doesn't get the attention it deserves. Healthy, recovered arms mean you can stay in the game and give your best on the field, and that's where MarkPro comes in. MarkPro is a cutting-edge recovery tool that provides all the benefits of active recovery, but without the extra effort, muscular fatigue, or stress to tendons and joints. Players can use MarkPro as long as needed for exceptional recovery between training sessions or after games. We'll often send MarkPro units back with athletes to their hotels or even have them use them on team flights. Both easy to use and portable, MarkPro is a powerful tool that allows recovery anywhere, anytime. Use it while relaxing at home, on the road, or during tournaments. On a personal note, I was originally a naysayer when it came to MarkPro. However, longtime Cressy Sports performance athlete Corey Kluber turned me onto it. He adopted MarkPro into his post-pitching recovery approach, and it was an integral part of him going out and throwing 200 innings year after year. This led me to experiment with it myself and with more of our athletes, and the feedback was consistently outstanding. Now, just a few years later, you'll see it in every major league organization as part of the routines of some of the most accomplished baseball players on the planet. If you're looking for the same results enjoyed by these athletes, visit markpro.com and use the coupon code Cressy at checkout for an exclusive discount. Again, that's markpro.com, M-A-R-C-P-R-O.com, and use the coupon code Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y, at checkout for an exclusive discount. Today's guest brings over 10 years of experience in educating and training athletes from youth sports to the professional levels. He's worked with business executives and athletes in the U.S. Olympics, NFL, NBA, MLB, UFC, and the NCAA to provide data-driven insights for performance and health. He currently operates as the Vice President of Performance and Brand at Hawken Dynamics and previously held roles as Director of Sports Science and Content Manager. Before joining Hawken Dynamics, he worked as the Applied Sports Scientist for the University of Illinois men's and women's basketball team. He graduated from St. Ambrose University with 2 degrees in exercise science and human performance and holds a master's in exercise physiology and nutrition from Liberty University. He's also a small business owner with 9 years of business and marketing experience, including a youth athlete training facility and fitness technology consulting business. His approach to using data to enhance and monitor athletic performance is unique in the performance industry, in which he consults and provides support for many of Hawken Dynamics customers to merge their processes with the Hawken Dynamics system. Please welcome to the show, Drake Berberet. Drake, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for carving out some time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be on.
So normally I'm excited for podcasts, but I'm actually extra excited for podcasts because you are coming to us from the great state of Maine, which holds a special place in my heart, God's country. I did not realize this until probably 3+ years of using Hawken Forest Plates that you guys were located in Westbrook, Maine.
Yeah, the company actually started in Boston, I think probably for a couple of weeks or a month, and then it gravitated up to just outside of Portland, Maine, nice. Shortly after.
So literally 20 minutes from my hometown. So it made me extra devoted consumer of Hawken. So I think maybe the best place to start with this is, I've used them on a regular basis, and they're a really I guess, impactful component of our offerings. And it made me dramatically better, not just as a strength and conditioning coach, but as a tag along to rehabilitation professionals and things like that. But you know, I don't think I've necessarily ever taken the time to think about like the origins of force plates, where they began, how they became what they are. And I know your path kind of followed some of that stuff. So maybe let's talk about your road to becoming the force plate guy that, you know, everybody in the industry like, kind of has to call when they have a question or a tech support issue or whatever it is. What intrigued you the most about getting into this realm of performance training?
Yeah, everybody's going to be let down from that. So we'll try to follow that up. But no, you kind of mentioned the origin of force plates first, and that's kind of something we've been trying to figure out on the behind the scenes. Dr. Jason Lake, actually, he's a professor over at Chichester in the UK. He's kind of like, I don't want to say like the godfather, but he's the guy that has kind of put out a lot of like the math behind a lot of the force plates that are being used. He really makes sure all of our stuff is sound before it goes into the system. But he recently just put together like a history of force plates. And I originally thought it went back to like 1960s, 1970s. It goes back to like the 1800s. Like it's like a lot further than I thought. And not really like your traditional force plate as you see it today, or not even, I mean, probably 10 years ago. But like force sensors and them being wrote about in different textbooks and research articles. So it's pretty cool because like this industry is not new, but as we see it today, like it feels new to a lot of people because the technology really hasn't been accessible. Mm-hmm. But for me, I got involved in force plates, I think in 2016, 2015, that's when I really started using it in practice. I think my first experience of just getting my hands on it was in undergrad in kinesiology lab, probably like a lot of other people that are listening. But we just had them in our kinesiology lab, and they were Burtec force plates with, I think we were just processing the data on MATLAB. So like, you know, we were athletes in college. So like we were jumping on the plates. We thought it was cool, but we didn't really take anything away from it until the teacher was like, hey, go home, process the data, write a report, like essentially just get jump height and maybe a couple other metrics like peak force. So that was kind of my first taste of it. But then when I got actually went on, was a strength coach at a D2 school, a little bit in the private sector. And then I got at a place in outside of Denver, Colorado called Resilience Code. And I worked for a guy there named Max Marzo. We had access to force plates and a software that was a little quicker to use, made the information more, not real time, but we could jump someone and see the information on the screen. It was a Neuraxon software. It was still like table format. So like, it wasn't like charts, reports, anything like that. It was, you know, quick to draw insight, but if you were trained on it, you could look at the screen, you could, you know, make a decision. And we were doing this for like one-off people that would come in, they would pay like a high sticker price to get a performance assessment along with their medical assessments and blood work and a bunch of other stuff we were doing there. But then we also had like a group of MMA fighters that we saw every week. So we were actually applying that on them, day in and day out in that setting, but that still wasn't as quick as it could be. So I didn't know it at the time, but pretty soon after that, I actually started at Illinois basketball, and that is where I first came into contact with like a wireless force plate that had a software that was a little quicker to use, and it happened to be Hawk and Dynamics. So that was Adam Fletcher, the guy that he's still there. He actually had purchased them a few months before I got there. So I get in there, start using the system. I just knew that, hey, he chose the system over the other ones on the market because of said reasons. I just started using it, and I was like, damn, this is really cool. This is easy to use, easier than my two previous experiences. So I went on the website, Hawk and Dynamics, started learning, trying to read a little more, found a little form at the bottom of the screen and just said, hey, like, I think these things are really cool. Have a social media. I think I could help people know about these, you know, blogs, social media, whatever it is. And then Ben, the founder, wrote me back. I think it was like, hey, I'll connect you with our marketing guy. And it was his brother. So got connected with him. He was really the operations guy. But like 2 weeks later, I think after two phone calls, I started working for him part-time, just making content and kind of some educational material. And yeah, I've been with him ever since. So I'm coming up on 5 years, I think, next month.
That's awesome. What was the unique draw? Like you mentioned, like, hey, I can create content here. Clearly, like, to experiment with something, but then to also realize that I can teach about this tells me you were playing around with it. You were learning. You were seeing, you know, downstream favorable impacts of implementing it. What was the stuff that jumped out at you and made you the most excited when you were, you know, a young strength coach jumping into this world?
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of experience before with like jump devices. So like, you know, Tendo unit, strap them to your waist, G-Flight, jump mat, all that stuff. And I'd say I was pretty far down the rabbit hole of like applying that jump information. So when we got the force plates, obviously a continuation of all that. But then I just started playing around with like other test types. I really, like, probably some strategy metrics, like different time-based things, modified RSI, asymmetry. But I probably didn't realize like the true impact of what a force plate can do until closer to that summer. And it was when Fletch, we were in the weight room, we were just messing around with the plates one day, you know, doing random tests with different tags and just playing around. And we started thinking about programming for that summer, and he kind of challenged me to, and it was like, hey, this is great. Like, we've been consistently collecting force plate jumps the whole season. We do it every single day on game days, practice days, just when we trained them. So we had a big data set, but he was like, this is great, but how do we train anyone based on this information? So I remember there was a, it was a question that kind of left my head. I was like, damn, you're right. Like, we've been collecting really good information and using it in monitoring, but how do we make a program unique to an individual based on this stuff? And you kind of go back to that mantra of like bucketing athletes. So that was kind of the place to start. But there was a whiteboard in there. So we just started like drawing on the whiteboard and brainstorming. And eventually we got to just drawing a force time curve on the whiteboard of a counter movement jump. And then we started asking questions. And so we started talking and we were like, what areas of this, like what is perfect? And then what areas could we impact if it wasn't perfect? And then like, what exercise selection could we plug in here if something didn't look the way we wanted it to look? And that's kind of when I got exposed to the idea of like shape and signature and how we could use that to train someone, but also driver metrics. And I'd probably say even driver metrics clicked more for me about 2.5 years ago when I was at Colby College, which we can get into that. But that was a way different environment than Illinois basketball. So different set of challenges and using force plates.
So those are your aha moments. And I'm curious, you know, it's one thing to be in a sample size of one, you know, a guy in a weight room nerding out, right?
Yeah.
It's another thing altogether when you start dealing with, you know, a larger population of coaches from around the country, around the world, like, you know, there's a data set that comes with it. So when your customers are playing around with Hawking force plates for the first time, like, what do you think the big aha moments are that jump out for them? Like, I know I'll share mine afterwards, but what are some of the things that you think were the most surprising for them that they've related to you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, one that is the craziest part is that since we do have so many customers here and so many different, like, unique customers, it's not like your football, basketball, baseball, typical, like, American sports. Like, we're getting, like, karate, ballerinas, yeah, skiers, skaters, like a whole bunch of different populations, like circus, all the different military groups. So, you know, they ask different questions. We have to be able to help answer them based on what we know about, you know, working with different sports. But I would say the biggest aha moment for a lot of people, and this is part of like a presentation that I give often when I speak, is on that shape piece. So it's kind of like that conversation. It was really my aha moment in the weight room there at the University of Illinois when I drew the curve on it and I started talking about what would be optimal, what is not an optimal shape, and then what would you do to influence that shape with your training exercises. So just moving through that shape and saying, hey, this is what's happening to the body at these different points in time, like providing orientation on the curve of, hey, this is when the knees might come into the most amount of flexion at this point in the jump. Hey, at the very top between braking and propulsion, that's when the whole body's coiled up at the bottom. So we know that, hey, that's like an amortization moment. They've just braked really hard and then they have to turn around and move their entire mass that they just threw at the ground away from the plate. So like we know that the whole body's coiled up at that point in time. So really just looking at that shape, talking people through that, and then it kind of clicks like, oh, damn, I didn't know that, you know, it gave us that sort of information. So
that's interesting. You know, the one that blew me away was, I think we've always heard in conversation about how quickly power detrains, right? That strength, aerobic capacity, these are, these are qualities that stick around. Actually, watching some guys who are going through Tommy John rehab and monitoring their force plate metrics, is you think about what happens in many cases, like they get injured and there's kind of like this 2-week time period where they're like waiting for an appointment with a doctor, they're traveling for it. You know, they're obviously not throwing, and which is arguably their greatest power stimulus in season is actually going out and playing their sport. So there's kind of like a little bit of a detraining that takes place in there. And then maybe they have the surgery. We're usually looking at, you know, 10 to 14 days at the very least before they can get back into a weight room with the risk of infection. So before you know it, you're at a month of just not a whole lot of activity. But then the challenge is like, you can't go out and just like sprint these guys. Like their arms are in braces, and you know, not only that, like sometimes they've got residual swelling, you know, there may be situations where they're on painkillers, things like that. So you're, you know, you kind of tack a couple weeks on it before you can even like put their hands on their hips and have them do another counter movement jump. It's just,
right.
And even then, like some guys, it's just the, you know, like the actual impact forces just don't feel great. So in many cases, we're looking at a downtime of like 7-8 weeks of really being able to push power. And what blew me away was how quickly some of these guys, you know, whether we're looking at jump momentum, whether we're looking at peak velocity, they fell off pretty quickly. And it kind of matched up to what we had always thought about with power. But what blew me away was, you know, you think about the muscle memory and, you know, if you've had it, it'll come back quick. Strength comes back really fast. Like we have guys that come back from a long season who might not lift at all. And they're, you know, they're deadlifting 500 within a month. Like we got to scratch and claw over 3 months to get these guys back to their baseline lower extremity power output numbers by the 5-month mark. And the force plates are a great way to monitor it. But, you know, I think often we see these athletes who are getting cleared to go back and start their throwing program. And, you know, you've focused on elbow range of motion and rotator cuff strength and all this stuff. And no one's really bothered to take into account that maybe their lower half was massively detrained, particularly if you have someone who had a lower extremity graft site that might even be more held back. So that was a really big aha moment for me, is like, man, this detrains fast and it is stubborn to come back even when you identify that it's a need. So really eye-opening for me. And it kind of makes me glad to some degree that sometimes the Tommy John rehab is so long, because it gives you a little bit more of a window to attack some of those key qualities that fall off really fast.
Yeah. It's we've obviously had some scenarios here in just the 5 years doing this of like people that have progressed athletes back and they're like, hey, this person's ready to go back. Do you mind taking a look at their data and tell us what you think? And you get in there and you're like, hey, like they're literally not even breaking through their left leg at all. Like they're not unweighting or breaking. They're doing a counter movement jump, but they're doing a squat jump on their left leg. Like they're not using this leg. And the same can be said for, you know, upper body assessments that you do on the plates.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think often we clear guys because they hit a timeline. Hey, you're at three months, you're good to do this. And in reality, it should be like, hey, you've actually rehabilitated. It's not just that the tissue is structurally sound and the repair is healed. It's that you've actually retrained some of the neuromuscular qualities that may have led to the problem in the first place. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, kind of to your point about understanding, you know, the signatures, a lot of people appreciate the benefits of force plates, maybe in the context of force velocity profiling, how to train athletes more individually. You know, they understand that it's about evaluating power production capabilities and certainly like improving return to play outcomes. But I'm curious, like, what are the overlooked benefits, you know, are that you've seen? You know, in other words, what are some of the key benefits of using force plates that you think get overlooked by, you know, consumers and folks that may be, you know, potential consumer prospects?
Yeah. So you have your main kind of three use cases, which are your monitoring, your profiling, or your benchmarking, and that's to compare athletes between themselves and 2 points in time or themselves and a group of people, or your return to play. But I think, you know, going back to like that signature piece, people forget that force plates, it's just like a really objective measurement of movement over time. So we're just tracking how someone is changing day to day to day. We may do that in different scenarios, which we talked about before. But just something as simple as like looking at that force time curve from day one to day two to day three to day four to however long you have them can tell you a lot about, I mean, not only your training and how your training is impacting that shape, but also like different things outside of training that are influencing that shape. So, you know, you probably talk about stressors a lot on this, this podcast or, with your players, but like if someone, sits on a plane for, you know, the whole day and then doesn't sleep that well, then comes in and tries to train, like their range of motion is probably going to be restricted a little bit. They're not, their depth's not going to be as far. They're not going to break as quickly or as hard. So, you know, we can pick that up on a plate and say, hey, all these things are down. You can try to restore them within that session. So some people will notice something when they come in. They will try to make adjustments with exercise selection or restoring range of motion, and then they'll jump them again within that same session. Just as like, hey, this is what we're going to improve in this block of time. And that's a win for today. So it really kind of always comes back to that signature, that shape, telling us more of a story than we think.
I think people overlook how, these aren't all just chronic changes, right? Some of these are transient things that that good coaching and effective programming can manipulate within the training session as well. Certainly see that in like the rehab realm, like, you know, we have a post-op ACL that's at the facility right now and just putting him on and having him understand kind of like how his weight distribution is actually positioned when he walks in versus how it is after some manual therapy interventions, some exercise interventions, just kind of rewiring the system a little bit.
Yeah. Like we did massage work at Illinois, or Fletch did, and I kind of just, you know, ran the Theragun, but guys would come in the day after the game and they would need body work, and he was a licensed massage therapist. So we would, you know, warm them up, jump them on the plates, do an 45 minutes, an hour of body work, and then jump them again. And those shapes would look entirely different. Yeah. You know, like it's just, you know, giving some soft tissue work, manipulating their joints. And then, hey, like this person, you know, their readiness is completely high again. And we really just manipulated some tissue.
So, you know, it's on the readiness front, and I'm kind of pivoting in away from my initial set of questions just because I'm curious, is there's obviously going to be variance, right? And you know, it's kind of like people who wear, you know, some of these like readiness trackers, you know, whether it's an Oura Ring or Whoop Band or anything like that. And, you know, we'll have days when your readiness is terrible, but you go in and you jump out of the gym, right? And other days where, you know, maybe you think you should feel good, but you're hanging for whatever reason. Those are sometimes the days where you come in, you extend your warm up, and you actually wind up feeling awesome, even though it wasn't great when you came in. I'm curious, like what's an acceptable amount of variance for you when you're actually using a force plate to monitor readiness? Like, do you have a specific number in mind, or what's your take on it?
Yeah, I try to get, you know, I try to do it the correct way of using stats to identify like how far out they might be using like a standard deviation or a Z-score. You can use things like smallest worthwhile change. Those are all things that research would say use this. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, it's tough because like, yeah, you want to have those principles of knowing like this is what a real change is, but also like you're working day in and day out with those athletes and you kind of begin to understand, hey, maybe this guy's bandwidth of like, you know, what is ready for him is a little wider than this person. Like we had this guy on the basketball team that like we just called him like the Energizer Bunny. Like he could experience the highest amount of volume in practice in a game back to back to back, and other guys would be tanking and his numbers never fell. Like he could just keep going. So, you know, like 90% of our team may have had like low readiness or been down, but he was completely fine. So I think it's hard to say, like obviously research it just for it to be true, it needs to have like a certain level of like, hey, 70% of the group experienced this. Well, like we and you, especially like you operate in elite sports. So, you know, 30% of those guys that may be all of the 30% that you're working with. Mm-hmm. So it's really just establishing like what is the normal bandwidth for that person and then kind of having a feel, you know, with you working with them is, hey, like this person, maybe they've changed a little bit too much this day, and consistently changing. So it's not just like one attempt that's low. It's two, three attempts within that session that are lower before I like to make a call.
You know, one of the things that I've found that's challenging about it is like, you know, so we jump just a ton of our guys every Monday, right? It's kind of like, you know, they're going to have a lower body day. There's some plyos and some progressive sprint work before they start it up. So there's, you know, they're naturally kind of warmed up to test it. It gives us a little bit of a benchmark for the week. And I think the challenge tends to be, hey, we're intentionally imposing fatigue. Like we're trying to create adaptation. Like I don't want them to be 100% ready every day in the off season, because that's a sign that all we're doing is sitting around and resting. You know, so you probably get the best indicator on Monday when they've had the day off on Sunday. But you know, I always, you know, you got to be careful not to get too caught up in the fact that, all right, we're down 3% today. That might be part of the plan, and we're going to hopefully get a little super compensation. You know, we take a deload every fourth week and they're going to come back better. But there is a psychological aspect to it where you got to relate to the athlete. He's like, I don't want you awesome on every single quality all the time. There's going to be like an ebb and a flow throughout the year. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, completely. And this is especially in basketball. Like, we obviously sold a lot of force plates in the basketball market early because it makes sense. It's a jumping sport. I came from basketball. That was kind of, I knew a lot of people in there. But that was a big thing for almost all of them that I was working with, was like, you know, they would, and contrary to like all the books and everything, like jumps pretty much go up all the way through the season. Like they don't ever tank in season. Your jump height doesn't really go down. Like you really, almost everybody will jump higher as a team all the way until the season ends. But then when they start training them in the summer and they have these plans and they're like, we're going to increase it this much, et cetera, it'll start to tank. And then, you know, we get phone calls like, hey, like what, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why why they're all tanking. And you have to realize like, hey, maybe that first block of summer we're really trying to fatigue them and we're inducing this upon them. So it's a great thing that they're tanking right before July, when you have, you know, the next 10 days, 14 days off, and then they come back and then you want to see it go up, and then they're going to tank again because coach is going to have a high volume in October or whatever when he's preparing for the season. And then you just want to come out of it again before, you know, the conference play starts. You don't want to keep them buried in that hole. But that's the great thing about the plates, is it doesn't just have to show you the good data. Like, it shows you the bad data, and that's just as valuable to look at.
Well, and the key is the trend reports, right? It's one thing to get three data points and be like, oh, I'm down compared to what I was 4 weeks ago. It's another thing altogether when you test an athlete for 2+ years and you realize that there's ebbs and flows, there's hills and valleys to it, but the general upward trend is taking place. And I also like it as a sneaky way to monitor body weight.
You don't want that to go up always.
Yeah, you catch yourself going to do the Newton calculation and everything on your iPhone when you see it. But I do think it's something to have in your back pocket. That's maybe it's not perfect, right? You're not guaranteeing that they're fasted or anything like that, or that they're wearing the same shoes as last time. But I do think it's a good little general indicator and a quick way of getting it that's more convenient than scheduling weigh-ins and things like that.
Oh yeah, that's cool. Like, people that have used the plates since the beginning, you know, some guys will have 5-6 years of body weights. So, and especially like our founder's daughters, they're like 12, but he's tested them since they were 6, right? So you just look at their progression of body weight and jump height. It's pretty cool to look at.
I have 9, our daughters, we have twin 8-year-olds that are about to turn 9. And I actually want to start getting them jumping on it. Most, not because I'm like one of those crazy dads or anything like that. I'm just a nerd that would appreciate like what 9 years of data would look like. It'd be cool to see like, all right, they started doing mommy's lift every Sunday, and then they got actually involved in it, you know? So it's kind of an interesting thing that I'd be kind of neat to scrutinize, but we'll have you back on the app, back on the podcast in 9 years to review the collection with me. So, you know, piggybacking on another previous question, like, athletes are always drawn to jump height, right? Like, naturally, you know, it's what they compete on. Like, we got Hawkins, and you know, sure enough, there's like a dry erase board there, and our pro guys are calling each other out and they're writing their jump height. I'm like, yeah, he's 185 and you're 250. Like, these are very different indicators. Where should we redirect their attention? You know, if you're looking at all the measures, you know, do you go MRSI? Where do you go with your thought process as you try to effectively frame the big picture discussion with athletes?
Yeah, I think it's probably sport specific. But within each sport, there's probably commonalities in like within each position. So if someone, and I would like to do this with part of my PhD, but if someone really sat down and just looked at all the different sports, all the positions, you could probably identify like, hey, there's really like 5 categories here of different body types, and this is the outputs that would make sense for these groups and the different drivers and strategies and so on and so forth. But yeah, everybody looks at jump high first and makes the most sense because, you know, you are jumping on a plate. But I think for certain populations, jump momentum probably makes sense as well because it has body weight included in.
Yeah.
You want to look at that really within a position group. So people that are in the same, you're expecting the same things out of them. Like, I wouldn't compare a jump momentum to like a shortstop versus like probably a pitcher, because usually bigger body types. But if you're trying to look like across the board, I tend to lean towards peak relative propulsive power. or average relative propulsive power. Kind of a mouthful, but you know, PRPP is a big one. Yeah. But like we did the NFL combine and NBA combine this year. So we tested every single person, and that was a metric that we used to score them all because of the vast body types we were looking at. But jump momentum is a unique one, because there's actually research behind that that'll say, hey, if someone increases their jump momentum on the plates, their sprint momentum also is likely to increase. You know, of course, if they are actually sprinting outside of that. But that was shown in rugby by Dr. John McMahon. So you can kind of apply that to football and say, hey, all right, rugby is a lot kind of similar to football, same demands. But then you could even think, okay, what other sports require like a massive horizontal momentum? To me, in working with the pitchers at Colby College, the place I was at, I was thinking like, okay, they have to throw their mass very fast towards home plate. So jump momentum might be something that would be important for those pitchers. And that in another metric was what we used to kind of serve as a KPI for our pitchers that were coming in.
I like that. You know, I think at the end of the day, you always want to assess and not assume, right? So you certainly have your movement screens. You know, we look at, you know, skeletal archetype, wide versus narrow infrasternal angles. We look at hypermobility status. And so this is part of it, right? This is how you interact with the ground. And we also use Proteus, which I kind of joke is like a rotational force plate, and layering some of those things on top of each other, I think has been really, really powerful. We're excited about digging even further deep on that. But one of the things we found actually in the Proteus side of things, we had Will Waterman from there kind of talk about it, was this fascinating kind of observation that when you take high school guys and compare them to college guys, the athleticism surges when you go to college. I think the latest one we looked at was like an 8% improvement from seniors versus freshmen in college. What was fascinating is like the improvement was really trivial between college and pro athletes, right? It was in the order of like 1%. And I want to say there's some unpublished data that even showed, I think it was the Texas Rangers group that showed that, minor league force plate numbers were actually better than major league force plate numbers. So I'm curious, like what, it's sports specific, but what do you think some of the biggest differences you see in trends, qualities, standards between high school and college athletes or college versus pros?
Yeah, I think it probably matters more for the sport and the position. Like for example, football. So like I've worked with D3 football, and we have a lot of Division I football customers, and then we did the combine, right? So like I was looking at the different output values of each level. And if we look at something just like peak propulsive power, so essentially just what do they have? Like what kind of juice is underneath the hood there? Our top values at like a D3 level were like 5,000 to 6,000, where, at the combine, like they're 8,000-9,000. So it's a pretty big level of just, how much output can this person produce? Mm-hmm. For baseball, I was kind of looking up some stuff before we hopped on here. I don't know if I think the outputs, they'd be different, but something that I like to look at as well is a metric called breaking net impulse. It's essentially, I almost use that as like a gauge of strength for someone, because, hey, this person has gotten stronger and they've developed the ability to break, their body mass. And I was looking at the baseball group. So, the D3, it was about 95 to 110 was our average. And, this is like 30,000. It's a lot of data points. It's a ton. The MLB groups that I kind of work with or help out, they were around 125 to 135. And then someone that I would say has a consistently work with a little more, theirs was higher. It was like 142, I think is what it was. So if you take breaking net impulse as a value of like strength, then it's saying that, hey, okay, if you're playing in the MLB, then those guys are a little stronger, which obviously makes sense. But we kind of just validate that with the force plates and with the data that we're exploring. So I would kind of answer your question from the beginning. I would say that probably the output metrics are going to be the biggest things, like your powers. And then the driver metrics will change more incrementally, but not as drastic as the outputs.
Would you say that at the highest level, they're using this more as a for monitoring, for, measures of H-chemistry, things like that, versus like, hey, it's hard to make an NFL running back that much faster,
Yeah, it's not like, so you can put your money in a better asset, So there's better stocks to pick. And I think the force plates have a lot of value there for people that are using it that way. So if you feel really good about applying this information, you can certainly assess risk on the force plates. Like, we have asymmetry because they're bilateral plates, but also what if you know someone has a history of injury, they have a high asymmetry, and they don't decelerate or break their mass at all? Like, to me, those are three things that, hey, this probably puts them at a little higher risk. We know they have a history of injury. If two people have the same outputs and they kind of have the same skill sets, but one has a higher risk, maybe we're not going to put our money into that individual or that stock. So I'd say that's how I would be using them, you know, if I was there in that position. But yeah, certainly in the monitoring piece, like, we have a lot of NBA college teams that travel around the plates, and we'll take them, you know, wherever they play.
We just touched on asymmetry, and this is a hot topic. Like, is one, to be honest, this is a rabbit hole I've gone down really, really deeply over the last year, along with some mutual friends of ours that do a lot in this space. And, you know, on one hand, in the baseball community, it's a favorable adaptation, right? If you've got retroversion on your proximal humerus, like, you're going to throw a baseball harder, and it's probably going to spare your elbow and your anterior capsule and your shoulder. So that, you know, that's a favorable adaptation that probably shifts your arc 15 degrees in range of motion. But at the other end of the spectrum, you don't want it to become excessive. You know, I'm curious, you've obviously scrutinized the data like crazy. I've, you know, spent a lot of hours staring off into blackness at 3 a.m. trying to ponder it. Are there any key takeaways that you have from your observation of one side dominant athletes, baseball players? I don't even know if I would throw tennis players into this, because they hit backhands. You know, we're looking at pitchers and guys that don't switch hit.
I think for pitchers, I tend to see the front side leg having, you know, that's almost always the leg that they favor. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can tell me I'm wrong right now, but I've seen both. What I tend to see.
Yeah. And I've also seen guys that, you know, for losing the percentage rank, that'll go 20% in one direction one day and then 20% in the other direction. Just like, maybe it's just the nature of a long competitive season and guys, you know, just not even knowing what zip code they're in at times. I think we've seen some guys with some pretty elite breaking forces on their lead leg that they post up on. It's basically the parking brake when you're going 100 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if that's consistent with your observations.
Yeah. And that's why, so I said earlier that gel momentum metric is something I like to look at for pitchers, and breaking an impulse additionally is another one, because their demands are, hey, move this thing really fast horizontally towards home plate, and also break really hard on that front side leg so you can torque over the top of it. So for me, those are like two big KPIs for a pitcher. But within the asymmetry realm, like, I think they typically will favor that leg. But if you're kind of looking at it for monitoring or for readiness, like, whatever they're favoring it normally, like, you say, hey, their normal is they're going to favor their right side 5%. To me, it's just a change from that set point. So, you know, you guys test frequently, so it's like you know what someone's normal is. Yeah. And then it's just a change from that. It's not necessarily like, hey, it needs to be within 15 or it can't be outside of that. Like, if someone's normal is 12 and they move, you know, 10 that way and they're 22, like, yeah, 22 seems pretty damn high. But if we're like, hey, they're a pitcher, we know this, have some context about them, they only changed, you know, 10%. You know, it's kind of a judgment call at that point, but it's not like, you know, a hard coded value to me. That's not really what I use.
I like it. I alluded to them early a little bit, but, you know, I love trend reports that we can roll out with athletes, you know, particularly over a lengthier time period, to see how they may evolve, you know, athletically or, you know, from a rehabilitation standpoint. If someone buys, you know, Hawken Dynamics force plates and they say, hey, I want to do this right over my next 2 years, right? I've got a collection of high school, college, and some professional athletes in the private sector. What are the key measures? Because you can obviously select a million different options on what you want to scrutinize. It gives you a wealth of data, and, you know, it can be overwhelming if you don't know what you're looking at. What do you think the measures that should be monitored the most over an extended period of time are? And then, you know, as the tag along that, you know, what are the red flags that coaches should watch out for?
Yeah. So, kind of like, what metrics would I say for someone new?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So one, if someone says that like very broad, I'll usually just pick like a few outputs, a few drivers, a few strategies. It's usually like a list of like, I don't know, 8 to 10. We can go ahead and name them now. But it'd be like jump height, jump momentum, peak relative propulsive power if you need to compare against, you know, lots of different body types and ages. Time to take off, system weight, left to right average braking force. So we kind of just accomplish our outputs and our strategies. And then it's going to be, hey, what things will actually tell us, hey, this person's much different than this person. They're the same age, play the same sport. Those are our drivers. So that would be things like, I like braking net impulse and propulsive net impulse. So that's just, hey, it's impulse is force and time, but I conceptually like to explain it as like work. So like how much capacity do they have within the braking phase? How much capacity do they have within propulsive phase? So I look at both of those things to tell me that. But then I also want to answer, okay, how well do they actually get braking net impulse into propulsive net impulse? Because if they can't bridge that gap and get it into propulsion, then they're not going to jump high, because that's really what gives you your velocity when you leave the plate. So I like to look at impulse ratio, which is the strategy of those two. And then relative force at minimum displacement, it's that point right between braking and propulsion. It's essentially like that amortization period. Mm-hmm. So when they're coiled at the bottom, everything's fully loaded. How much force are they putting into the plate at that point in time, relative to their weight? So, you know, we've got something for braking, got something for amortization, got something for propulsion. I like to look at peak relative landing. So I kind of have like a gauge there. So if someone new comes, jumps on the plates, I'm assessing them. I've kind of found like 500 is kind of like, that's pretty average for almost every single data set I look at. It's really like 450 to 500. So if they're like 500 to 700, I'll be like, okay, that's kind of yellow. It's not like, if they're under, it's green. If it's above, it's yellow. If they get 700 to 1,000, that would be, you know, I'd label them like orange. This might be someone, hey, we're going to maybe think about addressing landing mechanics, maybe talking through it, maybe plugging in some certain exercises. If they're consistently above 1,000, then that would be something I'm like, hey, like every single time they jump, they're landing with 10 times body weight. So we know that's probably not a good thing if that's taking place. So we'll address that. We had an athlete in Illinois that was 300 pounds, 7-footer, landed above 10 times body weight every single time he landed. So that was like, hey, this is a lot of mass falling at 10 times body weight. So we need to address it.
And people get worried about whether 12-year-olds lifting weights is dangerous, right? Like the ground reaction forces and sprinting, jumping, just blow your 15-pound goblet squat out of the water.
Way higher. And that might be it for metrics. I mean, you could look at modified RSI, but you know, if we look at jump height and time to take off, that's the same thing. Those are kind of like your basic core metrics. And then you kind of veer off into like more sport specific things. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, it's you really just have to ask yourself, or whoever I'm working with, like, hey, what sports do you have? What are their demands? You kind of think about what's important in that sport, and then you pick a metric that tells you something about that. So if braking is really important in your sport, like high change of direction, I would pick, like, I would lean towards braking net impulse. I like braking RFD for benchmarking. I know it's like that has the highest variation out of any metric on any force plate, braking mm-hmm. RFD does. So it gets scrutinized a lot. But to me, when you kind of take a step back and look at it, you know, over a month, or like if you compare in like a combine setting, this athlete for this versus this athlete, you can use that metric to say, hey, our best wide receiver on the team that is a really good slot receiver that can put his foot in the ground and cut out of that and race down the sideline, like his breaking RFD is 30,000. Let's look at this other receiver that is at 7,000 that doesn't have that ability. Like that metric will tell you it does have value. And then like average relative braking power, maybe use that KPI for a sport that has a lot of change of direction elements to it. So yeah, I think that kind of closes that bucket. But going back to your point about lifting and youth athletes, yeah, it's crazy. Like once you start getting on a force plate, you kind of think like, oh, I'm gonna load up the trap bar to as much weight as I can possibly lift, and I'm gonna do it on the force plate. But it's like you do that and it's kind of disappointing because you're like, well, that's way less force than I produce if I fell from a counter movement jump.
Yep.
So it's kind of like an insightful moment, I think, for a lot of people too, to realize that.
And it gets you maybe a little bit more pensive about like how strong is strong enough, right? Are we actually replicating the forces that we encounter in sports, or, you know, is it one of those things where the weight room just has to be do enough to support all the other stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious, just mostly because I've heard you like think through some problems as we've talked. What gets you excited right now? Like what's this, you know, I joked about me staring off into blackness, thinking about stuff. I'm like, I got to assume your wheels are always turning about how you can be using this in different ways, more exciting ways. Like, is there what's the next realm that you're really passionate about underneath this umbrella?
I've asked that question multiple times before, and I feel like I've gone through different phases of applying this information. Like one, I would say within the last 3 years was to try to really scale like some sort of model to a larger organization. So that was kind of, I helped out at D3 school Colby. We had 765 athletes, 32 sports teams. So it was like, hey, how do I do what I was doing in Illinois where we had 16 guys, you know, 16 girls, and do it for 32 sport coaches, athletic directors, physical therapists, and 765 kids? And, you know, how do we do that with no resources? So that was cool. I think, like for me now, I'm trying to answer questions that our customers have been asking for as long as I've been here that we really still haven't been able to answer. So I'm trying to move a little more into research. I've been really applied within this information, but I'm trying to take those questions that have been asked and then actually answer them in a research setting. So that'll be like the questions that I ask in my PhD and try to answer. I would like to, scaling it and creating like the recruiting piece and like the talent identification. That's really exciting. I haven't really been in a scenario where I've been able to maximize that. But I feel really good about, hey, if I was in that situation, I think I would have, you know, a lot of the answers based on this experience. Those are probably the two things that keep me up at 3 a.m.
That's exciting stuff. I mean, the point is that you have a million different data points with every jump, right? And because of that, you can look at things through a different lens. 5 years down the road, if you read something or you come across an athlete that gets you thinking in different ways. So I think, you know, sometimes we collect data just for the sake of collecting data. And I think that has like maybe a derogatory connotation, but in reality, sometimes you're just waiting for innovation to tell you what to do with it. I know that was the case. Dr. Kramer was one of my master's thesis advisors at the University of Connecticut. And I just remember him, like he was spinning off, you know, studies on data he collected in like the early 80s when I was in grad school in the early 2000s. So I really think there's something to be said for, you know, being a student of it and always have it in your back pocket so you can see how the trends might emerge down the road.
Yeah. For people that are interested in this stuff, that works. But there, I think we work with a lot of people too that just kind of want the answers and they're not really engaged in like the process of learning and trying to answer their own questions. And, you know, the people that really care about this information, it can kind of be frustrating because you're like, why can you not just like think through this problem and want to solve it? They just want the answer. I think for people that are always looking for the answer and they have that data set, that's really powerful when those two things together.
I mean, the lesson is to be curious, you know, keep asking good questions. I think you've done that. So folks can check you out on Instagram at strength2.speed. You always have actually some really good insights up there. And then if folks are interested in learning more about Hawken Dynamics, it's hawkendynamics.com/Cressy. You guys set up a special page for our listeners to check out and learn a little bit more about it. Drake, can't thank you enough for taking the time to share some insights. This was some really good stuff. I learned a lot. I actually got some notes off to the side here from a scribble and trying to keep eye contact with you going as we're going. So I'm sure I'll have a million more follow-up questions. So I apologize in advance for bombarding you with inquiries in the weeks that follow here.
No worries. Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for all you do. And hopefully we'll catch up again soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. We really appreciate you carving out some time in your schedule to listen, not just to this episode, but also to some of the episodes from our archives. If you enjoy what you heard, we'd love it if you'd share it with friends, colleagues, and teammates, as well as leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks again for your time.